Good afternoon. This is Chair Ruth Richardson, and pursuant to House Rule 10.1, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance.
Chair Richardson?
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan?
Present.
Representative Erickson?
Present.
Representative Drozkowski?
Present.
Representative Bennett?
Present.
Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bowe?
Present.
Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier? Representative Jordan?
Present.
Representative Keeler?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Scott? Representative Erdahl?
Present.
Representative Wasliwick? Representative Frazier? Representative Scott? Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Poston, have you had an opportunity to review our minutes from March 5th?
Madam Chair, I have, and I would like to move those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Poston. Any discussion to the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering why, when we have a recorded vote, it's not listed on the minutes. You know, individually, because when we do re-referrals, for most of the time, we've had recorded votes. So I find that a little interesting that it just says motion prevailed, but does not record how members voted.
Thank you for the question, Representative Erickson. My understanding is that if we have a roll call, that would be a vote that we would indicate with the names. But if it is just a calling of the roll to take votes, that we have not had the precedent of recording it within that way. So that's how we've approached that.
So, Madam Chair, we would have to call for a roll call to have our vote recorded. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Erickson.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Members, today we are having an informational hearing on House File 874. No formal action is going to be taken on the bill. There will not be a vote taken, and the bill author will not be moving it. The bill author, Vice Chair Hassan, has about 20 minutes to present her bill with a number of presenters. Then we will proceed with public testimony, alternating between those who support and those who have concerns or are opposed. Due to the nature of remote hearings and our live stream capacity, we do have a hard stop time and must adjourn the meeting by 2:30 p.m. With that, Vice Chair Hassan, you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I first want to thank everyone on this call today. As I understand, all of us are here because we care about our students and their educational experience. I also want to thank Chair Richardson for her unyielding efforts to address our shameful disparities and continuing to combat systemic racism in our education system. Today we have House File 874, which is an act relating to education, addressing fundamental right to quality public education for all children provided, and constitutional amendment proposed. It's imperative that I take the opportunity to also thank Justice Alan Page, who has been a fine example of excellence and a champion for our students. Justice Page has been a real model for many BIPOC students. I have asked my son about him And I quote, he said, he was the best player Vikings ever had with a high-pitched voice. And he went on to speak football language to highlight Justin Page's achievement. I don't understand football, so my only takeaway from my son's 10-minute glorification of Justin Page was that he was the greatest of all times. My son is a senior in high school and loves basketball and football. He is also an excellent student. However, his educational journey has not been a smooth ride. I had to fight daily microaggressions, racism, and pure bias to get him where he is today. As an educated mother who is super involved in my son's educational outcomes, I had struggled to exist within the system, so did my son. And I'm sure many parents from the BIPOC communities will tell you the same story. I have been getting a lot of emails about this amendment and what it does. Many are super excited about something that might be able to address our shameful educational disparities, and others have concerns or questions. Well, I'm thrilled to tell you that many of your questions and concerns will be addressed today. They say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting change, and that's what we have been doing when it comes to addressing our educational disparities and inequities. Here are some facts about education. Minnesota has the largest gaps in the nation by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic outcomes status. Disparities are not confined to race and ethnicity. Low-income white students significantly trail higher-income white students across Minnesota. Disparities span all parts of the state and all types of schools, whether district or charter schools. Achievement gaps are evident across a variety of measures, including standardized test scores, graduation rates, and college readiness indicators. Our current constitutional language was written in 1857 when slavery was still legal, Native Americans didn't have any rights, and women could not vote. Therefore, we shouldn't be surprised that if our system is only working for the people it was intended to in 1857. It's crucial to shed a light on the fact that this proposed amendment won't solve all of our educational inequities. We need to fully fund schools. We need to fund full community service schools. We need to fund trauma-informed coaching in our schools. We need to fund Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers Act. We need and must address housing crisis, wealth inequities, and systemic racism to be able to fully tackle this beast we call opportunity gap. With that, Madam Chair, I invite Justice Alan Page to explain more of this amendment to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hassan. Justice Page.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Hassan, Lead Republican Erickson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to, for holding the hearing and for allowing me to participate and explain our proposed amendment. Let me begin with where we are. Our current constitutional language, as the Minnesota Supreme Court held in 1993 in Skeen v. State, provides for an adequate education system. As Vice Chair Hassan noted, that language, the current language, which talks about the requirement for the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools, is from 1857. I might just note that not only was slavery a part of what this nation was about in 1857, but in 1857, the United States Supreme Court decided Dred Scott v. Sanford. And in that court's opinion, the Chief Justice of the United States, referring to those who had been imported as slaves, said that those who had been imported as slaves had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. That is the context and the foundation upon which our current constitutional language is built. it should not be a surprise that the system, and I don't think there is any question about this, has systematically and systemically failed children of color, indigenous children, but not only children of color and indigenous children, but poor children, poor white children. And given that focus on the system and where we are today, President of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, Neil Kashkari, and I have proposed this amendment, which shifts the focus to include children. We're not educating a system, we're educating children. And so we propose that, and I'll just go through the language quickly, all children have a fundamental right. When we say all children, the language means all children. Black children, brown children, indigenous children, rural children, urban children, wealthy children, poor children, able-bodied and disabled children. All children have a fundamental right to a quality public education. And to the extent that there are those who suggest that this language, this proposed amendment, is about something other than public education, I'm not sure how you get there, given that we're talking about a fundamental right to a quality public education. And I would note that there seems to be some concern raised by those who would be home educators about this language. Those home educators don't fall under the rubric of public education. And so I'm not sure what their concerns are. But given that the focus here is public education, not homeschooling, not private schools, not private education, I'm not sure what the concerns are. At any rate, all children have a fundamental right to a quality public education that fully prepares them with the skills necessary for participation in our economy, our democracy, and our society. Fully prepares them with the skills necessary. That is what quality means. Full preparation for participation in our economy, our society, and our democracy. As measured against uniform standards set forth by the state, what does that mean? Well, whatever it means, it doesn't mean constitutionalizing the current regimen of testing that we use today that doesn't tell us anything about how children are performing and certainly doesn't help children advance. That language is there to ensure that whatever measurement tool is decided upon is applied uniformly across the board. Finally, the last sentence, it is a paramount duty of the state. That is to say, the state would have no higher duty. It is the paramount duty of the state to ensure quality public schools that fulfill this fundamental right. And I note that, again, we're talking about ensuring quality public schools. The current language of our Constitution talks about the legislature, by taxation or otherwise, providing for schools. Well, as a paramount duty, I don't see how you can ensure quality public schools without funding. That language is inclusive of the current language's requirement that schools be funded. The other thing that the language does is it makes the state responsible. And in doing so, that includes the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. The value of having education as a civil right is that when that right is not fulfilled, a child, their parents, will be able to step forward and have that right fulfilled by the courts. And that is central to our proposed amendment. Now, as I said, there are those who oppose what we do. But I think the words of Denise Specht, the president of Education Minnesota, at the governor's conference when he introduced his new Due North program, Due North plan, I think are telling, and I think are apropos to what's going on here. And I would just like to share those words with you. And I'm quoting here. Now, I know it's only a matter of hours before we start hearing from the critics. Many will complain that public schools are failing, while simultaneously arguing that we must not change these schools, and certainly not in ways that shake the foundation of the critics' privileged places in the world. To those critics, I ask an honest question. Who benefits from the criticism? Is it the adults or is it students? To those who oppose this proposed amendment, I too ask an honest question. Who do those criticisms benefit? Who does that opposition benefit? Those who seek to retain power? Or is it the students who have been systematically and systemically failed by our current constitutional language? Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Page, for your testimony. Up next, we have Neil Kashkari.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, Vice Chair Hassan, and Republican Lead Erickson, and members of the committee. I know the chair has organized this hearing to focus on community, which I think is the right place to focus. And so with that, with your approval, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Aline Churimoff, who's the Senior Vice President of Community Development at the Minneapolis Fed, to offer our perspective on what this means for community. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Sharma.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Aline Churimoff, and I'm Senior Vice President of Community Development and Engagement at the Minneapolis Fed. My team focuses on policy issues that impact community, from affordable housing to access to credit. I'm also the mom of two little boys who attend public school in Minneapolis. I wanted to start my testimony today by addressing a question that we often get, and that is, why is the Fed engaged in education? U.S. Congress has provided the Fed a mandate to achieve maximum employment, and that is as many people as possible participating in our economy. We know that the single most important determinant of job market success is a quality education. So our work today in education really builds upon our many years of leadership in early childhood development. Representative Hassan and Justice Page pointed out that Minnesota has some of the worst K-12 education disparities in the country. Those are racial disparities, but they're also socioeconomic disparities. And that means low-income children across the state are trailing their more affluent peers. And some people will say that those disparities are the result of poverty or imperfect families or culture, and that we have to solve those problems before we can address educational outcomes for children. But our research has shown that other states have actually made tremendous progress in lifting up the educational performance of kids of color and poor children in their states. They still have poverty. They still have families who are struggling. It is ultimately the education system that is helping to lift those children up. Madam Chair and members, if there's one thing that you take from my testimony today, is that we must reject the arguments that we must first solve for poverty and first solve for families in trouble before we can address educational outcomes. We know that the research shows that that's not true, and I can tell you from my own personal family experience that that's also not true. We must find the will to fundamentally transform our education system to meet the needs of every child in the state of Minnesota, and we believe that the Page Amendment is a tool to accomplish that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Professor Bodhi. Rep. Hassan is yielding some of her presentation time to Professor Bodhi from the Education Law Center.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and other members of this committee. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Elise Bodhi. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to appear before you today. I note that my husband will be excited to know that I saw Justice Page in this hearing, who is also one of his heroes. I am a law professor at Rutgers Law School in New Jersey, and am one of the legal scholars and advocates who signed a letter addressed to this body in opposition to this proposed constitutional amendment. I'll start by quickly sharing some of my background. Before I joined the Rutgers faculty, I directed the National Litigation Program at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. As some of you may know, the Legal Defense Fund brought the landmark United States Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education. I have spent the better part of my career protecting the promise of Brown, including through my current work facilitating litigation that challenges school segregation in New Jersey and that seeks to build educational equity for Black and Latinx children in our state. Like the state of Minnesota, New Jersey has strong state constitutional provisions that protect public education in ways that have benefited low-income children and children of color. In fact, those of us who are working to improve educational opportunity in New Jersey have looked to the important Education Clause precedent set by the Minnesota Supreme Court to help guide our efforts. I am here today because I am concerned about the bad precedent that this proposed change to the Minnesota Constitution could set for New Jersey. Let me quickly offer three examples taken from the letter I signed about why this proposed amendment threatens to weaken rather than strengthen the civil rights of students in Minnesota. And let me also be clear that I have no doubt about the good intentions of some of the people who are offering this amendment. First, by eliminating the Education Clause in its entirety, this proposed amendment threatens existing decisions by the Minnesota Supreme Court that the Education Clause creates a legislative duty to provide an adequate education. I emphasize here that the word adequate has significant legal meaning in the educational context beyond what the plain language suggests. Indeed, as your court stated in Cruz-Guzman, an education that does not equip Minnesotans to discharge their duties as citizens intelligently cannot fulfill the legislature's duty to provide an adequate education under the Education Clause. While the proposal introduces language such as quality and paramount that might seem promising, as a practical matter, this language has no defined meaning in existing law, which, as you know, operates through precedent. Second, the proposal would eliminate the requirement that public schools be general, uniform, thorough, and efficient. This change could weaken the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Cruz-Guzman, which held that claims based on racial segregation are indisputably justiciable, and which the court also observed that a segregated system of public schools is self-evidently unconstitutional. And third, the proposal eliminates the reference to taxation as a means for securing school funding and therefore removes the provisions that currently require minimum levels of funding for public schools. I understand that there is still much work to be done to improve educational equity for low-income children and children of color in Minnesota. As someone who is deeply committed to improving education for all children, I also very much understand and sympathize with the frustration some might feel and the resulting temptation to reach for something new. But all that glitters is not gold. And so I ask, what does this language provide that could not already be legislated by this body under the current Education Clause? This amendment might seem to come bearing gifts, but with its clear and unclear and untested language, I suspect that it is really a Trojan horse that creates an unacceptable risk of unraveling hard-won educational victories for Minnesota's most vulnerable children. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. And up next, Rep. Hassan is yielding some of her presentation time to Representative Krisha, and then we will move into public testimony. Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Education Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present my support for House File 874. And as a co-sponsor, to this education amendment, I'm encouraged by the list of supporters and recognize that anyone who has put their name on this bill is willing to shift the conversation from upholding an education system to the educational right to a quality education for all children. Justice Page and President Kashkari offer this amendment because they know powerful special interests and entrenched bureaucracies stand in the way of education innovation, progress, and student-centered solutions. One of the first staunch opponents was Education Minnesota, who made their opposing comments public on social media, in editorials, and in many personal outreach from members directly to me. We spend more than $10 billion per year on public education, with more than $500 million per year on programs aimed directly at reducing an academic performance gap with little to no impact. In the words of Justice Page, we've been spending more and more money and getting the same poor results. I couldn't agree more. This has to change. This amendment is aimed squarely at improving our system of public schools for all those who choose its benefits. The status quo is justifiably concerned with a right to a public education being a quality, not only adequate education. A right to a quality public education is a right to a quality teacher, not the first teacher hired. A right to a quality public education is a right to curriculum, not just agendas and special interests. A right to a quality public education is a right to high standards and expectations, not excuses, quick outs, or social promotions. It's a right for students to reach their potential. A right to a quality public education is a right to accountability and verification through assessment, agreed upon standards, not just grade inflation and meaningless diplomas. And right, and when a right is denied, there should be a right for a parent to find a quality education for their children or to be able to challenge that. There are many who are eager to fight for the preservation of a merely adequate public education. Taxpayers deserve better, parents deserve better, more importantly, our children deserve better. This isn't about budget targets or protecting turf or continuing failed programs because we are too afraid to admit an idea didn't work. It's about higher expectations. It's about believing every child is capable of success. It's about meeting them where they are and turning them loose so that they can reach the opportunity they are bound to reach. It's about a system serving students, not protecting adults. Our current adult-centered system has not found a reliable way to help deeply disadvantaged children. In fact, we have created a bureaucratic system of government agencies that follows the kids haphazardly through childhood and into adolescence. The arguments against this amendment have been coming from special interest groups who have already secured their rights and bureaucracies. Some of the arguments go like this. The bill will take away X right or create a litigation quandary that will prevent change. The reality is this carefully worded amendment only expands the right of children who are not represented today. As for the litigation, we've already witnessed court proceedings to keep teachers out of the schools rather than finding ways.
Representative Kusha, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up. We have over 50 people who signed up to testify.
I have two sentences left. Thank you, Madam Chair. As for the litigation, we have recently witnessed court proceedings to keep teachers out of the school rather than finding ways to address the learning loss in front of us. If you are satisfied with the adequate education being one of the national leaders in the high achievement gap, then we should keep doing what we're doing and not move this language forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to move on to public testimony. We have each testifier will be given up to 2 minutes, and we will have staff time that. We have had over 50 people sign up to testify, so we will not get to everyone who has signed up. If we do not get to you today, you are encouraged to submit written testimony after the hearing as well. We'll be alternating between those who support and those who have concerns or are opposed, and we'll be calling the name of the person who is next and who is on deck. When it's your turn, please unmute yourself, turn your camera on, and again, please try to keep it to 2 minutes because I will have to cut individuals off in order for us to get to as many people as possible. So to start, I have Dr. Mary Owen, and on deck, I have Nevada Littlewolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to speak today. I am a Native American physician and an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School. My job is to increase the numbers of Native American physicians who serve Native communities, communities that are grossly underserved. This region of the country, the Bemidji area of the Indian Health Service, which includes Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, has a physician vacancy rate of 46%. We need doctors who want to serve the Native people of this region, and who better than the Native doctors from here? But to get Native doctors, we need Native students. Yet every year, the University of Minnesota Medical School sees very few applicants from this region, and that's because Minnesota and Wisconsin, home to over 20 tribal nations, are two of the worst states in the nation for educational disparities. By failing to graduate close to 40% of its Native students, Minnesota is also failing to do enough to increase the pool of future physicians, Native physicians, to meet the health needs of Native people in the Bemidji region. This amendment is about more than education. It's also about health. Education impacts everything. I read an argument against this amendment that educational disparities are complex and impacted by issues outside of school, including poverty. Well, of course, poverty impacts education, but how do you get out of poverty? One avenue is by education. I've also seen an argument that this amendment will only lead to more questions, such as how do we develop a curriculum, hire appropriate teachers, and find funding to meet its requirements. Well, isn't that the point? Brown, Black, and poor kids have as much right to these basics as any wealthy white kid. If it takes a change in the Minnesota Constitution to get all these kids these rights, then so be it. Let's change the Constitution. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have Nevada Littlewolf up next, who's actually in support. And then on deck, we will have Yusef Mgeni and then Jim Hilbert. Nevada Littlewolf, please proceed with your introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. My name is Nevada Littlewolf. I'm leading and supporting the Page Amendment. I'm an Indigenous woman, a citizen of Leech Lake Nation in northern Minnesota. I raised my children on the Iron Range and before moving to Minneapolis 3 years ago. So they went to the Virginia-Minnesota public schools, and now my daughter, my 17-year-old daughter, who has Down syndrome, goes to Roosevelt High School in South Minneapolis. So this impacts me personally in terms of what I think about for my own children and our future generations. And I'm really excited to be leading around the community that we have in the work that we're doing with the Page Amendment. We have really centered community voices in this conversation. We have teachers and parents and students and youth. We have statewide people. We have 11 tribes. We have businesses. We have organizations. And we have individuals. And what we're building is powerful. I want to just talk a little bit about some things we have coming up after the hearing. March 22nd will be our week of action around the Page Amendment, and I really want people to get sort of energized and aware that that's going to be on be coming up. And it is just another way that we are engaging community and voices and centering community and voices and the diversity of Minnesota in these conversations around how we continue to define quality education, and we continue to bring, we continue as a community to drive the Page Amendment.
So 30 seconds remaining.
Miigwech, thank you, Chair Richardson, and thank you, Representative Hassan.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Yusef Mgeni and Jim Hilbert on deck.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson. and members of the House Education Policy Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share some of the NAACP's thoughts and concerns on House File 874 with you. I am the Vice President of the Minnesota-Dakota Area Conference, NAACP, and I'm speaking on behalf of W.C. Jordan, Jr., our Tri-State Conference President. The proposed page amendment raises significant concerns for the NAACP and would divert limited political resources in a direction unlikely to address the immense challenges facing Minnesota schools. There are more reliable ways to address achievement gaps. Funding meaningful integration, pre-K education, special ed, ELL, and a more fully prepared and inclusive teaching force and curriculum all have proven track records in improving educational and other important outcomes for all students. There's little to no evidence that simply amending our Constitution would do likewise. The NAACP agrees that the state's achievement gaps are a serious and long-lasting challenge requiring immediate attention. We also believe that there are available legislative policy and judicial rulings that have proven to address such gaps in other states. But again, the example provided by the Federal Reserve, I'm sorry.
You have 30 seconds. Please continue.
Sure. The example provided by the Federal Reserve is not among the most proven. Finally, we would like to recommend an incredibly informative book to the members of the committee by Rucker Johnson, who has done the most comprehensive national research on this topic in the last 50 years. The book is Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. And again, thank you for the opportunity to share some of our concerns with you today.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Jim Hilbert, and on deck, we have Dr. Bernadia Johnson. Jim Hilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm ad hoc counsel to the state NAACP. I'm also vice dean at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. As Vice President Mangini mentioned, we have filed a statement so we can be brief on this. Let me add one additional point. As Representative Hassan shared, the data is about shameful disparities and action is needed now. So turning to the amendment, we get into the specific legal issues, but changing the constitutional language to use the word quality guarantees nothing. And the description that the state must prepare students so that they can fully participate in the economy is still going to be subject to court interpretation. This is not a prescriptive change like we saw with voter ID or marriage equality or even what Florida did with its amended constitution. They amended their constitution. They put in place very specific caps on class sizes. As Professor Boddy explained, this is new language, and it's going to have to be interpreted by courts through lawsuits, all of which takes years and years and substantial investment of time and money by parents, presumably. Now, I have some experience in that. I was one of the lawyers for the Minneapolis NAACP back in 1995 on a desegregation case that was based on the state constitution. That case started in 1995. It ended in 2000 with a settlement where there was no court decision. The Cruz-Guzman case, another desegregation case based on the state constitution, that was filed in 2015, almost 6 years ago. It's still going. State constitutional cases about education in New Jersey, New Hampshire, and Texas and elsewhere have taken decades because the courts can find violations, but they resist imposing solutions. So our concern is simply this. Why not skip the years of litigation, the uncertainty of court rulings, and just get to the remedy? This is a critical conversation. We don't need to be talking about legalistic solutions. Let's talk about what the legislature can do right now. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Dr. Bernadia Johnson, and on deck, we have Professor Myron Orfield. Dr. Johnson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and Vice Chair Hassan. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today in support of the Page Amendment. My name is Dr. Bernadia Johnson. I'm an assistant professor at Minnesota State University, Mankato, and I served as the superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools for 10 years, as well as from 2010 to 2015, as well as I was a deputy superintendent of Memphis City Schools. And I come to this session today full of hope and optimism for the future. of our children, especially those who are least served well among all those who are served in our public education. I found the best way as an assistant professor to help grad students understand what's coming before them is to pull straight from the headlines. Saturday, I had class, so I had the great honor of connecting with people who are intellectually curious about education. And I tend to lead toward teaching the classes on legal issues, policy, et cetera. And so I found, like I said, to teach classes, these classes bring straight from the headlines into the classroom. So Saturday, we had a discussion on the Page Amendment, and it created quite a stir among those who, like I said, who have a lot of intellectual curiosity. Students were quick to point out the language changes and how old the amendment, the existing amendment is, and who the original amendment was put to serve, and what the differences of what we have now before us. And I have to say that I agree with them and added a few points to the statements. I remember without... I remember that talk about adequate. Adequate does not denote quality. You should never hire an adequate doctor, an adequate lawyer, or an adequate teacher, or an adequate superintendent. Adequate is uninspired. Minnesota children are bright, talented, and curious, and adequate systems just don't work. Actually, adequate to me means mediocrity. And going back to what we said, if the changes won't change it, what we have is not working either. And I have direct evidence of this. So option to go to the court was intriguing to them. Okay, I'm going to finish. All the roles I've identified are important to me, but I know the systems are challenging to change, and we know what needs to be done. We must have the courage to act, the courage to decide, the courage to dream of a better tomorrow for our children. And Lord, I want to be here to see that.
I'm going to have to cut you off.
I understand. No. But I want to be here to see that day with you, Ruth.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Professor Myron Orfield. And on deck, we have Sandra Samuels.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here today on this amendment. I'm not opposed to a new amendment to the Minnesota Constitution, but I'd like to make sure that the amendment and the guarantees that we have are protected. It would be very easy to make sure that the protections against segregation and for equal funding were included as a part of this amendment, but they aren't, and we don't know what it means. I've taught state constitutional law for 17 years. Many of the leading experts in the United States have testified, and I agree with what Professor Bode and Professor Hilbert say. We don't know what this language means. We know that we have a fundamental guarantee for children of Minnesota. We know what it means. We know that it involves a protection against segregation. We know that it involves a guarantee of equal funding. We don't know what this language means, and the Federal Reserve has been unwilling to share with us the research and the documentation that supports it. In any other circumstance, when a constitutional amendment would be forthcoming, all of the legal memorandum, all of the testimony, all of the public materials that were created to support this amendment would be part of the public record. I've asked for these materials a year ago. They were not forthcoming. The litigants in the Cruz Guzman lawsuit have asked for these materials. They aren't forthcoming. The public information non-for-profit had asked for these materials that aren't forthcoming. So I'd ask this committee to ask for all the materials that support this amendment. We certainly would like to see an expanded constitutional amendment, I would, one that would protect important rights, one that would advance equity. But all that we know with this amendment is all the guarantees that exist under law are gone, and we don't know what the new ones mean. We'd like to know what the new ones mean before there's a new constitutional amendment. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before this committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Sandra Samuels, and on deck, we have Michael Dunes. Ms. Samuels, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Sandra Samuels. I am president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone and a proud resident of North Minneapolis. Thank you, Chair Richardson and Vice Chair Hassan and committee members for bringing the Page Amendment forward. I want to start by saying I couldn't disagree with Dr. Bode Moore. And by the way, I am from New Jersey, and this is not New Jersey. Today, in fact, we are starting the trial for Officer Chauvin, who murdered George Floyd. And what I keep saying is that George Floyd's murder is the tip of the racist iceberg in Minnesota. Beneath the waterline are the disparities in housing, in home ownership. 76% of white Minnesotans own their own home. Only 24% of black Minnesotans own their own home. In income, black Minnesotans own only make $36,000 a year, white Minnesota, $83,000. And then when we get into, I could keep going, but when we get into education, again, we know that that gap is bigger than anywhere in the country. Again, this is not New Jersey. We know that education has always been the great equalizer. And right now, since everybody's making commitments to ending the egregious racial inequities in the state, why wouldn't we start with what is most important, and that is the future of our children. We have to codify the commitment that everybody across the state is making to ending racial injustice. We do that by passing this Page Amendment. We have to codify our commitment to our children, codify our commitment to this state being free of racial inequities, and codify the love that we have by doing everything possible. Pass this amendment as if the future of your children and your grandchildren depended on it. Thank you, Chair Richardson.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Michael Dunas, and on deck, we have Mike McFadden.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. I'm Michael Duenas, a third-generation Mexican-American. I'm the parent of a high school student who has only attended Minneapolis public schools since kindergarten. I'm the son of a sharecropper and a migrant farm worker from southern Minnesota who grew up farming and attending both rural and urban schools. I'm a first-generation college student with a PhD in political science from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and I focus on reducing racial disparities in education. I'm speaking against the proposed amendment because it only holds traditional public schools accountable using statewide testing as the educational standards, while charter and private schools will be exempt from the amendment because they are not required to do testing. The amendment as written creates a huge incentive for charter schools to not participate in statewide testing, to avoid being liable under the amendment, and to not accept or to expel underperforming students, which is the antithesis of the intent of this amendment. When I moved back to Minnesota to graduate from high school in the mid-1980s, we were the best state in the country for educating and graduating Latino students and one of the top states for educating African Americans. Everyone forgets that. Today, we are among the worst states for educating Latinos and African Americans, and American Indians continue to struggle, as do Asian Americans. Today, you will hear over and over that Minnesota's racial disparities in education are so bad that something has to be done. But the amendment before you ignores all the things that are best practices for reducing these racial disparities. It boils down to funding and bringing back resources that all our schools lost across the state, in particular, our rural schools and Twin Cities urban schools. The amendment as written will really disenfranchise rural and Twin City schools. These schools already struggle for resources and will be particularly hit hard. The amendment was not created with rural and small town families, schools, or educators, and could lead to fewer resources to these schools. As Justice Page said earlier when he opened up, who benefits and who pays? My question is, where is the money coming from for this amendment? Who is the money to settle these lawsuits going to come from? An individual school, the constituents in your district, the state? In settling these lawsuits, who will get the payout? Only an individual student or their family winning or settling their lawsuits? Will settling these lawsuits lead to even more inequality? As the amendment was written, it will create more inequality for even more Minnesota children. There are too many unanswered questions, and there are too many institutions that the amendment will not apply to, which is the antithesis of educating all our children and providing them a quality education. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Duenas. I'm sorry for mispronouncing your name.
It's all right.
Up next, we have Mike McFadden, and on deck, we have Jeff Pope.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank the Education Committee also, and a special thanks to Sandra Samuels. Sandra, you got me all fired up. Way to go. I'm a businessman, and I'm an education activist. I became an education activist through my service on the Crystal Ray Board of Directors, where I chaired the board the last 3 years of my 11-year term. As a businessman, I have always approached problems and tried to solve them. I pride myself on being a problem solver. And we have a tremendous problem in our state with respect to education inequities. It's been here for a long time. It's getting worse. It's not getting better. And we need to solve it. And as I've looked at it, I think the fundamental problem is that we have partisan gridlock. Republicans like myself want school choice. My friends in the DFL want more money into a system. We argue past each other and nothing gets done. We hide behind our arguments. I support the Page Amendment because it is a radically different approach. Instead of starting with divisive prescriptions and division, instead it starts with something that unifies all of us, and that is the rights of children, the right of a child to have access to a quality education. It's a value statement. Once we put that in place and enshrine it in our Constitution, then it will act as a catalyst to force action.
Meaning?
Thank you. Republicans and Democrats will have to work across the aisle to come up with solutions, meaningful solutions that produce change. Otherwise, it will go to the courts. And the courts, this will force action. I support it. Let's get our arms around something that unifies our state and doesn't divide it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Jeff Pope. And on deck, we have Mariama Adam. Jeff Pope.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Pope. I've been in education for 20 years, along with 4 years as a special education teacher in Burnsville. My students can't wait for years of lawsuits to see change in their schools. They need more than lofty promises. They need elected officials to take action now with an actual plan. Start investing in what we know students need and what works. We can start with the Due North plan submitted by Governor Walz, endorsed by Justice Page. Also, school integration funding and the CARES Act through ESSA can work to retain teachers of color right now. Minnesota must build culturally competent and anti-racist schools that serve our diverse communities and disrupts racist practices. That starts with the adults in our administration buildings, down to our classrooms, buses, and so on. We have policies that are intentionally preventing teachers of color to remain in their schools. These teachers maintain positive relationships with all students. Students of color who have teachers of color are significantly more likely to graduate from high school and enroll in college. Attracting, especially retaining, teachers of color must be a priority. I walked into an assembly with our high school juniors in 2016 and asked how many have had a teacher of color. A handful said one or two. In my experience, students are starving for teachers of color, especially Black students. Unfortunately, that is the norm in the vast majority of Minnesota schools. Although students of color comprise of about 35%, only 5.3% are teachers of color, are teachers who are people of color or American Indian. If we want all students to thrive and succeed, no matter race or place, Minnesota must simultaneously strengthen and transform its public schools, closing our state's racial and economic disparities. And also, many bills like Increase the Teacher of Color Act you can take action on right now. This can be funded through existing resources like the CARES Act and school integration funding. Our kids cannot wait. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I've been informed that Mariam Adam is not on the Zoom, so we will move on to Dennis Drawn. Please unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. And we'll have Amy Buckmeyer on, I'm sorry, we'll have T. Goodsky on deck.
Good
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dennis Strawn, and I'm a licensed social studies teacher on special assignment as an equity teacher in Osceola area schools where I grew up in. My job brings me into different schools, working with educators by providing culturally responsive curriculum through our district's CLEAR model and other system equity tools. My role provides me with a spotlight on what teachers are going through and the inequities in our schools every day. From what I've seen, it's clear to me that educators don't have the necessary resources to be successful in the classroom and throughout our system. This makes my position unnecessarily challenging and frustrating. When it comes to education, we always seem to look for the quick fixes, but there are no quick fixes to disrupting systems of racism. You can't change something if you don't have a plan. And the proposed constitutional amendment offers no specifics on how we will dismantle the disparities in Minnesota's public schools. Fortunately, we have things we can do right now to force change and transform our schools for our children. Legislators just need to make them happen. One, we need to start treating teaching like a profession. New teachers shouldn't start off their careers with massive education debt and salaries that aren't enough to pay the bills. Better pay and the student loan forgiveness will help attract the highly qualified teachers our students deserve into the profession, particularly teachers of color. Hiring educators of color isn't just enough. Supporting us is crucial. Principals need to ask us what we need, collaborate with us, not just tolerate us. Find time for us to connect across school buildings, give us the opportunity to develop curriculum that reflects our diverse learners, lift up, not stifle our voices when we speak up for what's best for our students, put us in the positions where we can grow and become leaders in our school districts. We are in this for the students, and every Minnesota student, no matter what they look like, deserves the best opportunities they can. The proposed constitutional amendment won't do that, and it could even make the stark disparities between wealthy and poor districts even worse.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I've been informed that Teague Goodsky is not in the Zoom, and so we will move on to Amy Buckmeyer and ask Dr. Fatima Lawson to be on deck. Amy Buckmeyer, please unmute and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Amy Buckmeyer, and I'm a staff attorney at the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, where we advocate for the rights of parents to direct the education and upbringing of their children. With over 100,000 member families, including several thousand in Minnesota, we are the world's largest homeschool advocacy organization. We acknowledge the intentions of the amendment's proponents to support quality education for Minnesota children. Government-funded education consumes massive resources, and lawmakers should require accountability and the very best outcome for all students. But there are no constitutional or statutory obstacles preventing lawmakers from requiring accountability or better outcomes now. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and final authority for interpreting it belongs to the Minnesota Supreme Court. Therefore, when it comes to interpreting the meaning of this constitutional amendment, the intentions of the authors and proponents of this bill are irrelevant. It will be the state and federal courts who decide cases based on what's before them, what it means that a student has a fundamental right to a quality public education. Many questions arise from this language. If a child has a right to a public education, would parents who home educate or enroll their child in a non-public school be denying this right? Could parents now be subject to educational neglect investigations for denying the rights of their children? Can a child sue because their education did not give them the skills necessary for participation in the economy, our democracy, and society? Who will decide what these skills are? It will not be the legislature or the local school districts who get to make these calls. These questions will become lawsuits before the court, and under this proposed amendment, one individual judge's swing vote could determine with finality Minnesota's educational policy. Minnesota students deserve better. The answer to issues of equality and equity is empowered parents and families, empowered with more choices, not more government. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Dr. Fatima Lawson, and on deck, we have Kirk Schneiderwind. Dr. Lawson.
Thank you very much, House Education Committee and Representative Richardson, for holding a hearing on the Page Amendment. I would also like to recognize Vice Chair Representative Hassan, with whom I had the privilege to work when we served on the Governance Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, and who is a supporter of Minnesota Africans United as well, on whose platform I'm here. My name is Fatima Lawson, and I'm an immigrant, a proud public school principal in St. Paul Public School System. I'm also a product of public school education. I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Africans United, otherwise known as MAU. This is a coalition and statewide organization for all African immigrant communities in Minnesota. I'm testifying and serving as a community voice here. MAU is proud to support this bold, transformative, community-driven education policy because education-based work diversifies and strengthens all policy arguments, especially policies that will touch the lives of each and every Minnesota child. As a school administrator and one who serves children of various backgrounds, experiences, and preparation, I have seen firsthand where access and opportunity to public education could make a huge difference in the development of our children for the sake of posterity. MAU is a champion in this endeavor, and feedback from community recently concluded education summit made it as clear as crystal that this is a well-needed lead. And one of our panelists, actually none other than Justice Page himself, and in his words, he talked about how quality education extends beyond funding to civil rights. That resonated with very many people. So MAU hopes that legislators in the Capitol will listen to community voices as you hear them today and hold additional hearings on the Page Amendment.
That's time.
Thank you. We are ready as Minnesotans, and we want you to
Thank you for your testimony. We'll have to move on. Up next, we have Kirk Schneiderwin, and on deck, we will have Dr. Raphael Onayegala, I believe. Mr. Schneiderwin.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderwin, Executive Director for the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent 333 of our public school boards who, as individuals, are elected by their communities to lead, manage, and govern their public school districts. A core value of each of our school boards is the performance, the outcomes of all of our students. MSBA and its members share the same passion, value, interest, and urgency of closing the opportunity or achievement gap and the overall success of our students. We recently conducted three focus group sessions from a broad, diverse group of school board members from around the state, understanding that the constitutional amendment will have statewide impact. We focused on issues around the amendment that will advance education, aspects that will be detrimental to the education, and potential changes that would increase our support for the amendment. I will say our board members took a very objective approach to the constitutional proposed language. Under the issues of advancement, they were very clear that they felt that the new language focused on children, not the systems. And I would contend that really is about our boards focusing on children is a current practice for many of our boards today. They felt that the paramount duty prioritizes education. They felt that it was strong language that would lead to stronger outcomes. The amended language also talks about outcomes. The current language does not. And I think that was a brilliant observation. And the word changing adequate to quality was very well accepted as well. And they liked the language, the fact that it would benefit all of our children. So what are some of the aspects that are detrimental? They were concerned about the language that removes the piece around requiring taxation to support our public schools. While paramount feels good, they needed more clarity. A larger issue in the room is the predictable full funding of our public schools is a real issue. An amendment about the language ignores the big piece for our school boards. And then they're also concerned about some additional unfunded mandates, as well as the legal decisions coming from courts. I think one of the big things that was surprising to us is the lack of understanding and clarity around what uniform standards means. While we have statewide academic standards, the issue of uniform standards really is not completely understood. And will that hold the school board and school district accountable, or is the goal to have the state held accountable? So I realize I'm very short on time, but having shared some of our major themes that we learned through our focus group, we also heard very clearly we would hate to see the uncertainties and the valid questions derail the discussion. and the good work that's being done for our public school and students. The interest in the discussion around the amendment,
Mr. Schneiderlin, expectations
was very evident among our members.
And up next, we have Dr. Raphael Anyegala, and on deck, we have Max Taylor.
Sorry, I needed to unmute myself. Thank you, Madam Chair, Justin, and good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Raphael Onyehala. I am a professor and dean at Southwest Minnesota State in Marshall, Minnesota. I am an African immigrant and a member of the Minnesota Africans United and serve as the chair of the Education Committee. I've been at Southwest Minnesota State for 19 years, and I've lived in rural Minnesota, Southwest Minnesota, in this town of Marshall for the same amount of years. I am very interested and supportive of this amendment because of the access it will provide to numerous students of color and Native Americans. I have seen firsthand, you know, as a faculty member at this institution and as an administrator, I've seen firsthand, you know, how limited or lack of access, you know, have led to students, you know, dropping out, and in most cases, you know, don't complete their degrees. So I will say this, you know, from the viewpoint of the Federal Reserve Bank, that as Minnesota demography continues to trend towards diversity, it is very, very important that we maintain the economic vitality of our state. Therefore, access to education for all children, as Justice Page said, for all children in Minnesota, you know, will ensure not only that we maintain individual economic vitality, but that of the state of Minnesota and the nation. Thank you very much for letting me be a part of this process.
Thank you, Dr. Onyegala, for your testimony. And up next, we have Max Taylor and Dr. Anusha Nath on deck. Max Taylor, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Max Taylor, and this is in regards to House File 874. At the heart of this bill is a desire to maintain a stable and free form of government for the state of Minnesota by ensuring that our children get an improved education. And I hold that sentiment in common with Representative Hassan, because as a Christian, I deeply value education and want to see improvement in the state of Minnesota. I mean, it was Jesus that said, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge," in Hosea 4:6. So education is definitely a big deal to God, who loves all people so much that he was willing to send his son to die for them. Now, just to clarify, this bill would make standardized state education mandatory and would leave the interpretation open to potential abolition of homeschooling and other forms of Christian or private education. So in essence, it would strip citizens of the choice to educate our children in accordance with our religious views or our personal academic standards. Now, as a Christian, I'm opposed to this amendment because fundamentally God lays that responsibility of the raising and educating of the children on the parents. Freedom of education is given by God himself. And really, this is about freedom. Just as slavery was wrong because it stripped freedom from a class of people, so this amendment would deny parents the freedom of how they wish to educate their children. Therefore, the parents should be free to decide who to entrust with the education of their children, not the state, just because that's the way God set it up. So, Madam Chair and other members, I want to see improved education outcomes in Minnesota schools, but this bill will not accomplish them. Therefore, I must oppose HF 874 as it is bad for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Dr. Anusha Nath, and on deck, we have Natalie Christensen. Dr. Nath, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. I'm Anusha Nath, research economist at the Minneapolis Central Bank. Today, I'll just start with talking about some of the research that we've been doing in the Minneapolis Fed in looking into what are the impacts of the education amendments in the other states since 1990s. And this was a question brought forth by Yusuf Manegi. And what we have been found, what we have been finding, is that an adoption of an amendment has resulted in better education outcomes as well as higher inputs into education. Specifically, we find that an amendment results in higher per pupil expenditure, higher teacher salaries, and also improvement, significant improvement in grade 4 reading test scores. In terms of what has been the policy changes, we find that on an average, the legislature does respond with enacting more education policies following an amendment. And we see an increase in enactment of these policies, not only in the number of policies enacted, but also the issues on which policies are based following an amendment. In addition, we find that there are no increase in court cases that reach the higher courts after an amendment. And this happens not only 1 year after, 2 years after, but persistently we see no increase in court cases. So what do these results show? There's an improvement in outcome. Legislature does implement policies after amendments have been passed, and there are no court case increases. This basically tells us that the courts are the last resort for citizens, and if the legislature is following policies, there's no need for citizens to go to court. So to answer Professor Jill Hilbert's question, what is this amendment going to do? It's going to facilitate changes in policies. All children have the fundamental right, means no matter which family you're born in or which zip code you're born in, there's going to be an equal chance or equal access to quality education under this amendment. And hearing research from other states.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to have to move on to the next testifiers now. Up next, we have Natalie Christensen, and on deck, we have Miriam Adam.
Thank you. While I believe the intentions of this bill are very good, I have some deep concerns with it. As others have pointed out, words such as quality and skills necessary for participation remain undefined. This vague wording is alarming, since the bill is stating there is a right to something that has not been defined. The bill also says that it is the state's duty to ensure quality public schools. The sponsors of this bill have themselves pointed out that over the last 15 years in Minnesota, 122 new pieces of education legislation have been made into law. They also indicate that no progress has resulted from these 122 laws. In fact, nothing lawmakers can do will ensure that instruction across the state is of completely equal quality. Students are individuals, and good teachers adjust their methods to help each unique child succeed. Again, how can the state ensure something that is not defined? The sponsor's website claims that the amendment is, quote, centering education on families and quality versus adequacy and uniformity. Yet the bill itself sets forth that educational success will be, quote, measured against uniform achievement standards set forth by the state. To me, the words uniform achievement standards set by the state sound much more like adequacy and uniformity rather than putting emphasis on families and quality. The wording of the bill emphasizes action by the state without recognizing the essential role of parents and guardians in the success of their child's education. It would undermine their rights and obligations as parents and severely limit their ability to effect change in their own local districts. Mr. Kashkari indicated that opponents are concerned about retaining power. I would point out that in many cases it is parents seeking to retain power in education. Quality of education is influenced most significantly by parents and teachers working in tandem to help their children rather than by amendments and statutes. Please reject this 123rd piece of ineffective legislation. Thank you for your time.
We have Miriam Adam, and on deck we have Ann Smith. Miriam Adam, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Miriam Adam. I'm an educator at Minneapolis Public Schools. I've been an educator for 18 years, and I'm an immigrant as well. I'm from Somalia. I grew up in Africa. And for me, this amendment is very dear to my heart. It is touching our most vulnerable, which are our students and our children. And the language quality and not adequate is really important because that really clearly makes the statement that we're looking
for quality education. And when we go out and look for quality education, we're going to look for the context of what does quality mean. We're going to include the curriculum, educators, and having the entire set where our students are able to be leveraged and their lived experiences, and having all children educated with a quality education. And when we say all children, we're referring to all our kids, immigrant, Native American students, black and brown kids, white kids who are poor. I mean, these are our kids. These are the most dearest that we have in our homes and in our schools. And I think doing business as usual and not getting much outcome, I think, requires that we do try to change things. And having policies that are focused toward improvement of education will support us in our mindset of thinking of better ways to reach out to our communities and improving our educational system to be able to have our 21st century workforce kids. If you look at the data and the history, unfortunately, we're behind compared to other nations, and not because of anything else, but it's really from the root, which is the great equalizer, which is our educational system. And having an educational system that prepares our students and leverages who they are and their knowledge and engages them in a curriculum that they can see themselves in, we're definitely going to regain and get our power as leaders in the educational field. I would like to just bring one more attention, and which is the amount of money that's been spent on public education, which is $10 billion and more, has been spent for quite a while, but we haven't seen the needle move that much. And so anyone in their right mind, by seeing that same amount of money, which is a lot of money, and not showing much progress or closing the achievement gap, is definitely crying for more need. And this is the start. This is a catalyst. Having this kind of amendment will have people talk about how can we change this. So this is a conversation that needs to be taken in every format and has to be spoken about in order to have change and have improvement in our schools. I think being an educator, I have seen this happen in my classroom daily, where I see that we need our kids to be able to be leveraged and to have an educational system that meets their needs and prepares them to be 21st century workforce employees.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Ann Smith, and on deck, we have Michael Fiscal.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, Justice Page, and members of the... Thank you for listening to my concerns today in regards to the constitutional amendment. I reviewed the Page Amendment question and answer document posted on the Minnesota Legislature website, and even after reading it, I still have some major concerns. The language is somewhat vague and open-ended, and therefore leaves much of it open to interpretation. Proponents argue that this language change does not endanger educational choices and parental rights, and is only trying to clarify the state's duty to ensure quality public education for students. However, by changing the language and leaving out any reference to private education or homeschooling options, it opens the door for judges and government to make rulings and interpretations based on the language, not the intent of the proposed change, which is good. I work in the private sector for a large global company as an auditor. My job is to ensure employees are adhering to our policies and procedures. One of my main challenges is dealing with a situation when an action occurs and it is not clearly defined in the policy, therefore making any disciplinary action or approved behavior change difficult. I see this as being an issue with the proposed language change. Instead of changing the language to appear and possibly be interpreted that all children must be educated at a public school, why not add a sentence clarifying that this does not apply to private schools and homeschooling families? That would be protecting the religious freedoms of all families, whether they choose to educate their children in a public school, private school, or at home. I urge you to all withdraw from this proposed legislation so that all families and their children's rights are protected. Disparities in quality of public education should be addressed in the legislature and through other avenues. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Michael Fiscal, and on deck, we have Jerry Gregory.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon. For the record, my name is Michael Fiscal. I'm the managing shareholder of Greenberg Traurig's Minneapolis office. Greenberg is an international law firm with more than 2,200 lawyers worldwide. I've been a resident of the state of Minnesota for more than 40 years. One of my four daughters is a first grade elementary school teacher. She taught in Webster Elementary in Minneapolis for 3 years, and now she teaches in Cedar Ridge Elementary in Eden Prairie. I'm a strong advocate for children, and I'm a strong advocate for public education. All four of my children have attended or are attending public schools. I am one of seven children raised in a lower income family. I was one of the first in my extended family to attend college. I was the first in my extended family to get a postgraduate degree. Access to quality education was the most important factor in my success and will be the most important factor in the success of our children. The amendment proposed by Justice Page will ensure that every child has a right to a quality education. Many of those at the hearing today are concerned that the passage of the Page Amendment will distract from the advances we have made in providing a quality education, or that it will mandate that every child attend public schools. It will not. It will only give all children in Minnesota the fundamental right to receive a quality education if they choose to attend public schools. I'd like to thank the House Education Policy Committee for the opportunity to be heard today. A quality education should be a shared value of all of us. The gap in educational quality in public schools across Minnesota is significant. The Page Amendment will ensure that we work with our legislators, educators, and significant business interests in our community to close that gap. Greenberg Traurig is a proud sponsor of the Page Amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, I have Jerry Gregory, and on deck, I have Heidi Wilkins. Not hearing from Jerry Gregory, we'll go to Heidi Wilkins.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. Pardon me, I wasn't expecting to go today due to the fact that there was enough people and I didn't have room, and now there is room for me. So my name is Heidi Wilkins. I am the Diversity and Education Coordinator at the Diversity Council in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm very much for changing the language of the Page to the Page Amendment because of the fact of, you know, when the Office of Civil Rights came out with their report about discipline disparities between Black and Brown students in Rochester, there wasn't much that we could do to get the problem fixed besides talk about it. We didn't have a leg to stand on. So I'm actually all for the vagueness of the language because it gives communities the right to interpret that as they will, what works best in the community, what works best for the students in those school districts. I'm out of breath, sorry. and finally, let's not forget that this is about our children. This isn't about politics. I know a lot of people have talked about the political gain or how much money it's gonna cost, but really what it comes down to is the achievement gap between our Black and Brown students and those who don't have the access to quality education. We know that this doesn't actually affect homeschool or private institutions. This is about accessing quality education in a public manner. Therefore, I feel like it's critically important that we get this amendment passed. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Emily Berkness, and on deck, we have Fatoon Ali. Emily Berkness, please unmute and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and distinguished education policy members. My name is Emily Berkness, and I live in Stillwater, Minnesota, and I've homeschooled all seven of my children, the oldest of which is a freshman at the University of Minnesota, and the youngest is in preschool. My husband and I both grew up in the public school system and never dreamed we would homeschool, but here we are. And I can tell you after 16 years of this endeavor, it has been without a doubt the single most life-altering and beneficial decision we've made for each and every one of them. And the current language in the Minnesota State Constitution protects the rights of all parents, regardless of race, to make that choice. And the bill you're considering today not only undermines it, but actually actively attacks it. So no constitutional amendment would be necessary. And the education of all of my children has each looked as unique as the child themselves. Because my husband and I have been able to meet each of them where they are on their own educational journey, We may have been able to help them realize their God-given potential and excel in a wide variety of talents and skills that they've been blessed with. The bill you're considering, intentionally or not, threatens that opportunity. So let me leave you with a final anecdote. We once had a pediatrician who was very skeptical of our decision to homeschool and regularly would quiz my kids on their numbers and letters until a visit when my three-year-old noticed a painting on the wall and innocently asked, "Mom, isn't that carnation Lily, Lily Rose by John Singer Sargent?"
30 seconds.
Said, "Yes, it is," and never was bothered again. I believe you're all really well-intentioned, and I share the goal of a wonderful education, but I just please ask you not to jeopardize the outstanding success stories that have been made possible in your efforts to improve public education.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Fatun Ali, and on deck, we have Paul and Rebecca Lundy. Not hearing from Ms. Ali. We'll move to Paul and Rebecca Lundy, and Tanya Drawn is on deck.
Okay. Hello.
Hello. Hello, everybody. We're not professionals at doing this. We're just an average family, and this is our sixth daughter. And obviously, we are concerned about education for all children in Minnesota. But we're going to share with you our experience. So we have six children, ages 15 to 33, and we've been homeschooling for the most part, a little bit of public education, but homeschooling for the most part. Four sons and two daughters adopted from Guatemala, and our children are 15 to 33. So we have five graduates, and they are in various positions and contributing members of the culture and the society now. We want to say that we are opposed to the current language, though we understand well-intentioned there are definitely needs that of other children and other families in our state that need to be talked about. We think that the ability to find quality education is important to us, and having the state define it doesn't make sense. Our kids were six unique individuals with specific struggles and weaknesses and also skills and interests. What was a quality math program for one child was less than ideal for another. Because we had freedom to pick and choose, each of our children got what they needed. We worked with at least three math programs over the years with just six children and had the freedom. So bottom line is we believe that our fundamental rights to homeschool would be impeded by this piece of legislation. And we believe that leaving the law as it is now would be the best, and that we should continue to make improvements with the law that we have. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. And I've been informed that Tanya Drawn is not on the Zoom call. Our last testifier will be Ideal Abdul, and then we will give Vice Chair Hassan the last word. Ideal Abdul, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, can you hear me?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay, I'm sorry. One of these days I'm going to get this. Again, Madam Chair and members, many thanks for the opportunity to give my opinion in this bill. I appreciate your time. Members of both parties have often said Minnesota needs to produce the best workforce. To get that, students must receive quality education. In other words, if our current law says adequate education, then our children will become adequate workforce, which we all know is mediocre workforce. I'm constantly shocked at the level of resistance for anything good by education in Minnesota and unions. I'm also appalled by those that say this will open the door for education lawsuits. So because adults who chose this profession and have created a current horrible education gap are afraid that a court will hold them accountable, therefore, let us just keep the status quo, which has not worked and failed our children. Madam Chair and members, would you go to a medical doctor whose logo is "We provide adequate care"? Would I take my son to an autism therapist that says I provide adequate therapy? Heck, would you even buy shoes from a store that says we sell adequate shoes?
The simple answer is heck no. But we are okay with our children getting adequate education. You know, the unions were started so that big corporations would not take advantage of their workers. But it was never intended to shortchange the customers. Minnesota's unions have gone to an unacceptable level of shortchanging our children who are the customers. All I can say now is that as a woman, as a minority, I'm ashamed so many people who look like me support these heartbreaking and hurtful policies that have created the education gap we are in now. If we cannot stand for our children against any unions or lobbyists, then what kind of human beings does that make us? I hear a lot of the homeschooling, and I also homeschooled my kid. My son has autism, and he has never, ever fully went to a public school. I've always done homeschooling and public education, public school together. And unless I'm mistaken, and maybe Tricia Page or the chair or Hassan can correct us, I don't think this affects if you homeschool your child. I think this affects if you take your child to a public school.
Ms. Abdul, I'm very sorry, but your audio is going in and out, and we have only a
thank
minute.
Thank you. No, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time as always, thank Madam
you.
Chair.
Thank you. And I'm going to give Vice Chair Hassan the last word, and my apologies to Representative Erickson, who just raised her hand, but we do have to end at 2:30. Vice Chair Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank everyone for indulging this lively discussion today. Indeed, we all care about education. I invite everyone to continue to engage more conversations around this issue, as this is the beginning of a wonderful partnership with you all. As a mother of two Black kids, a 17-year-old son and a 15-month-old toddler daughter, I am immensely committed to dismantle racism in our education system and disrupt the status quo. I will always fight for better educational outcomes for my kids and all other kids in the state of Minnesota. Please join us as we embark on something new. For the record, I'm a woman of faith, and I have zero intent to take away anyone's religious rights.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hassan. We are, I appreciate you, and we are adjourned.